Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents A Pastor Encounter Narrative, presented by Professor Shah Mahmoud Hanifi of James Madison University. This is the fourth lecture in a series entitled A Multidisciplinary Approach to the AFPAC Region and Its People, being hosted by MES at MCU. Dr. Hanifi is an associate professor of history at James Madison University, where he teaches courses on the history of the modern Middle East and South Asia. Dr. Hanifi holds a PhD from the University of Michigan and is the author of Connecting Histories in Afghanistan, 2008, in addition to numerous articles and book chapters on history and politics in Afghanistan. This lecture took place Monday, 5 April 2010, from 1400 to 1530 at Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad we have two ladies, so we can mention that. Welcome to the fourth in a series of lectures that we here at the Marine Corps University's Middle East Studies have called it a multidisciplinary approach to the AFPAC region and its people. And at this point, I want to underline the its people, because today what we'll be discussing will be the people. Those of you who have attended previous meetings, you know that the nexus and the basis of this whole series endeavor has been the directive by General Sterling McChrystal. And once we read that and seeing what he wants, when you look at the main points, I think he has about 10 to 12 points of what we ought to do in Afghanistan. Military action is the sixth in there. The very first one is about the people of Afghanistan. Second is governance, understanding the people, access to justice. And we think that these are very important points, but in the same time, we may not, within the PMEs, within the organizations that we serve, understand all the dynamics, the different perspectives of who these people are. We talk about them, and often sometimes something, this is my own personal view, I go to many conferences, attend many meetings, and what you see is sometimes once we create a theory, whether it is the tribes or the reason or whatever, once we have it, we polish it, we put it in PowerPoint, that becomes the gospel. Then even the reality changes. We do not change the reality theory to fit the reality, rather in our own mind, not out of lack of intelligence, but just it has a system. We change realities to fit our theory. I think after 8 years in Afghanistan and now Pakistan, we see that we all understand it's different shades of gray, yet we try to see it black and white. So what we thought we'd do is to reach out beyond what is normal, if you would, in the PME institutions and discuss aspects of Afghanistan and Pakistan, specifically to relating to the people and the governance, to understand nuances that we may miss. In a way, some people said you took a chance. The first person who came here, sat right in this room, was Professor James Cannon, who talked about poetry. I remember initially people were thinking as the Marine Corps listening to poetry. To tell you that talk, and especially now the paper that came out of it, we have had more than 100 requests from around the PME organizations and beyond to listen to it. How it goes, how that narrative conflicts or confirms the tribal engagement narrative, for example, just one aspect. So with that, we had the last speaker was Ambassador Peter Galbraith, and as you know now, he's smack in the middle of the news. We try to do current affairs. We like to do things that are important in the governance aspect. We also try to understand the historical and the people aspect. And with that, we are very honored to have Professor Hanifi here. Professor Shah Mahmoud Hanifi comes from actually our own Commonwealth. He teaches, he's a professor of history at James Madison University and teaches courses on history of the modern Middle East and South Asia. Dr. Hanifi holds a PhD from University of Michigan and is author of Connecting Histories of Afghanistan, which was published in 2008, in addition to numerous articles, book chapters on history and politics of Afghanistan. The title chosen for Professor Hanifi's talk right now is Pashtun Counter-Narrative. Those of you who are here, you heard one aspect of the narrative on our second lecture by Professor Robert McChesney. This will be something different. And lastly, we have DVDs of all the lectures. You're more than welcome. Some of them are right there. Adam Seitz, by the way, who without him, none of this would have been happening. He has those. If you want to be on our mailing list, please see Adam. And we are hoping that after the series finishes, all of these wonderful professors and scholars will give us papers which will be put in a book. So we further extend this information to the Marines, Army, and everybody else who's on the ground trying to make us successful in this endeavor. With further ado, Professor Hanifi, thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to be here. I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You're getting the thumbs up.
Yeah. Thank you very much to both Adam and Professor Tarzi for having me here, and for you choosing me over Tiger Woods, I guess, is the competition at this hour today. I have to say, I am truly humbled by the power you collectively represent. It's coming from the civil sector. This is quite an impressive array of resources that your university represents. And I'm impressed with your power, but I'm not, I should say very clearly up front, I'm not in favor of the war in Afghanistan, and I don't think all knowledge has to be directly cultivated for military purposes. Indeed, sometimes that is dangerous. And so my goal here today is not to give you a series of kind of practical insights by any stretch of the imagination. What my limited goal here is to help you think about Afghanistan and some of the questions that it raises. My title that was given here, the counter, Pashtun counter-narrative, is designed, I believe, to allow me the space to discuss what I see as a problematic understanding of Afghanistan, that is, that it's dominated by Pashtuns. And it's that understanding of the country that I'd like to kind of disentangle and unpack a bit today. By sharing a number of thoughts about the historical complexity of this region. So, what I should say in the first instance about the thesis, and I do trust that we can agree that this is a common approach to Afghanistan, that it's, there are two, I would say, working metaphors for the country. The first is that it's dominated by Pashtuns, and the second is that it's a failed state. And really, from the get-go, I have a hard time fitting those two metaphors together, primarily because I can't get through the mental gymnastics necessary to understand how anything that has failed, that doesn't work, can dominate anything successfully, effectively, consciously, thoroughly. A weak state, a failed state, can't dominate anything. And so, in the first instance here, we have a larger question about state-society relations and the idea of the Afghan state and Afghan society to reckon with here. And what I'd like to do is just offer, not random, but some organized initial thoughts on the history of the country, its social constituency, and its relationships to its surrounding territories. And one of the fundamental problems students of Afghanistan have is focusing on it in isolation from the things around it. And historically, Afghanistan is certainly related to its environment as well as the globe, and those connections are extremely important. Afghanistan's external connections, particularly, if I might advance the migrations of Afghans outside of the country and their return migration to the country, seems to be of much more importance for understanding political and social dynamics than Pashtun domination. So in place of an approach to the country predicated on ethnicity, I would like to suggest we look at the idea of migration and mobility as a more effective key to unlocking what's going on in Afghanistan. Mobility implies change. And one of the problems in treating Afghanistan as if it's of, by, and for Pashtuns alone, to the exclusion of other Afghans, is that there's no sense of changing relations within Pashtun groups themselves and between Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns in the social fabric of Afghanistan. So what I see as twin mantras, really, of Pashtun domination and a failed state, this, in a combined sense, is a rather tautological frame of reasoning. Tautology meaning something that I live because I breathe, and I'm breathing because I live. I'm a father because I have a son, and therefore I'm a father. It's the reasoning for Afghanistan is that what Afghanistan can be is due to Pashtuns. What it can't be is due to Pashtuns. Pashtuns make the state. Pashtuns break the state. This, to me, is incredibly circular. It's circular logic. It's tautological. And what I'd like to do today is to try to get outside of that circular reasoning with you. Right away, I think it's important to reckon with the incredibly deep time involved in Afghanistan. I have heard the number 5,000 years of history behind Afghanistan. I've heard other numbers, 2,000 years. But what I would like to draw your attention to is that despite having a very deep historical timeline, there's really very shallow history. There's a difference between time and history. History is about argumentation, how things fit together, and causation. And the timeline for Afghanistan doesn't really focus on causation. The historical timeline for Afghanistan, as deep as it is often anchored around individual personalities and biographies. And history as a discipline has moved away from kind of biographical approaches to its subject matter. And I'd like to move out of individual biographies as a way of understanding Afghanistan here today. So by way of structure, I should say, I have prepared a series of images that essentially carry us through this deep history of Afghanistan, beginning with some of the pre-Islamic eras through the Islamic period, really to the 19th century colonial encounter, which is really the center of my work. And some images kind of carrying us up through today. So the images are really, I should say, kind of background. Narrative won't be directly tied to the images, and I apologize if that's sort of dissynchronized or something. But images help. I'd like, if I could, to say a word just about my own biography. I was born in this country to an Afghan father and a Lebanese mother who met at Michigan State University. My father was one of two Afghans sent out of the country in 1956. And I should say, in some senses, I was an Afghan American before there were Afghan Americans. And it's been interesting to watch the growing demographic presence of Afghans in this country as my kind of adult years got underway in the 70s and 80s. And I am certainly now one of approximately 100,000 Afghans in this country. And this large diaspora of Afghans in Northern Virginia, Northern California, Germany,
India, I think is really critical for understanding Afghanistan. In fact, I think we can learn a lot about the country from outside of the country. I think the patterns of migration between diaspora communities throughout the world and the country itself is an important theme to explore. In fact, I'd like to offer an alternative model up front here. I'd like to offer the model of circular migration as a way to more effectively understand political dynamics in Afghanistan. Circular migration meaning something like this. Political elites in Afghanistan take power in connection to external resources. Political elites in the country, by the very nature of their connection to external resources and displays of power, generate outmigrations of individuals and populations that leave Afghanistan and enter the diaspora, many of whom come in contact with external powers, such as the Americans or the British and their net of institutions and resources. And it is through a relationship with those external powers and resources that migrants are repatriated, in turn setting off another cycle of outmigration, external connections, and repatriation. And we can go through, to some extent we will go through, the history of Afghanistan with this keen eye on movement and connection to external resources, at the very least as a way to improving our understanding of ethnic dynamics in the country. So, let me draw attention to the slide behind me, which is a rough, kind of crude chart that I put together from a WorldCat search a couple weeks ago or last week of a keyword, Afghanistan. And I went through and tried to identify through time how many books and other forms of publications, whether they're articles or pieces of journalism, appear in WorldCat with Afghanistan as a keyword. And what becomes immediately, I hope this is visible, excuse me, what becomes apparent is the dates of conflict or wars in Afghanistan are embedded here. And if you could please just try to train your eye and mind onto the surge of information associated with military conflicts in the country. And we have to do a bit of, reading between the lines here. But if we look at the Anglo-Afghan Wars of the 19th century, the first one being 1839 to 1842, the second one being 1878 to 1880, if we look at surrounding dates, we see a near doubling effect of information around these military conflicts, roughly. We see a similar effect since 2000 or 2001 and today, not quite doubling effect, but a 50% increase. We have a real, again, exponential growth in information about Afghanistan tied to military activities in the country. And it therefore makes sense that a lot of information about the country is structured or geared or calibrated to military concerns. But what is more important for understanding the intellectual architecture of the country is that some core ideas about Afghanistan get instilled and institutionalized through these publications and the circulation of these publications and even kind of oral dissemination of information from these written texts. And so what we have through the course of military conflicts and surges in literature are generally reinforcements of earlier ideas. Repetition and redundancy are primary characteristics of literature dealing with Afghanistan. The literature as a whole is in some ways crippled by its polysemy, the similar meanings for multiple words. And what I'm referencing here is the relationship between the words Pashtun, Afghan, and Pathan. These three words are really peppered throughout all of this literature. Those three words are sometimes held to be synonyms, exactly the same meaning. Afghans are Pashtuns, Pashtuns are Pathans, Afghans are Pathans. It, though, historically doesn't work that way. The word Afghan is a Persian word for all practical purposes that arose about 1,000 years ago in the context of medieval Islamic historiography. The word Pashtun emerges, let's say, roughly 500 years ago, or at least we know the Pashto language is firmly textualized about 500 years ago, in the context of the Mughal Empire. The word Pathan emerges a couple hundred years after that, in the 1600s and 1700s. But what happened when the British got to India in the late 1700s and 1800s is their attempt to make sense of India and its cultural complexity and history led to a kind of rolling over of these words in the colonial literature. And out of the colonial literature, we're left with a kind of intellectual fault line, I would call it, between these three categories that are in fact not the same thing, but are have a tendency to be grouped as the same thing. So what I'll do with the remainder of my time is try to let these slides go through kind of an automated way. I've got a large number of them. They'll stay up there for about 30 seconds apiece. And again, my comments won't be directly tied to the images that will become. And so, speaking of images, it seems to me one of the characteristics in the study of Afghanistan is that it contains really strong images. Afghanistan, the image of the Afghan girl, for example, is it's one of the world's most famous images. At the same time, from my vantage point, Afghanistan has rather weak words. Strong images and weak words. Weak words meaning that the scholarship of Afghanistan has not made a great deal of impact on any discipline outside of Afghanistan studies. Ironically, the scholarship of Afghanistan has been isolated from other intellectual developments in surrounding disciplines. So the treatment of Afghan tribalism or ethnicity or nationalism in Afghanistan generally is not informed by theorization of tribalism, ethnicity, and nationalism in the social sciences based upon data from Africa and the rest of the world. What, ironically, the literature of Afghanistan has kind of served to isolate the study of Afghanistan from larger intellectual inquiries. And so I think one way to make the words stronger is to amplify the theorization of what we're talking about when it comes to relationships for example, between tribes, ethnic groups, and nations in Afghanistan. More than singular, isolated treatments of a tribe or an ethnic group. The real trick to Afghanistan, it seems to me, is understanding how Afghans, like other people, have multiple layered identities of different types that coexist and can be amplified in certain ways. In other words, the chameleon nature of Afghan political life, where an individual can be a mujahid one day, a talib the next day, and a member of parliament the next day. To understand how that happens, we need to appreciate that the reservoir of the cultural repertoire that most Afghans can call on involves multiple languages, multiple territorial attachments, multiple connections to the outside world, multiple tribal, ethnic, and national ingredients. Nothing is exclusive in Afghanistan, particularly Pashtun populations, who have historically, first of all, a great deal of mobility, and secondly, a great deal of connections to non-Pashtuns. If you have the idea that Pashtuns are a xenophobic lot, you need to purge yourself of that idea. Pashtuns, or the tribalism that gives Pashtun identity its texture, is open, is sort of accommodating, expansive, not inward-looking and isolated or insular by any stretch of the imagination. So the images about Afghanistan being isolated, about it being an inward-looking society that helped to explain Pashtun domination, I counter with historical evidence about connections within the communities of Afghanistan in their own right and to the surrounding regions and indeed globally, secondarily. So I would like, if I could, to draw attention to two things about Afghanistan. First of all, the rural zone, which is normative. Afghanistan is fundamentally a rural place. Cities are sort of natural, of course. Urban life is a natural, historical, and human phenomena. But there, cities are to some extent aberrational, particularly Kabul, that has such a uniqueness to it. Kabul is so unique, in fact, that understanding Afghanistan through Kabul is, I think, a misreading of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is more an exception. Kabul is more an exception to what Afghanistan is than the rule. Understanding Kabul through Afghanistan will lead you down the wrong path, in my opinion. At the very least, we need to understand Kabul's relationship to its hinterland and Kabul's relationship to other cities, particularly Kandahar. And historically then, if we look at the map of Afghanistan through its urban locations, what the Taliban represent to me is far less fundamentalism or a threat to stability of international sorts than a resurgence of Kandahar. A lot of this is about, in my mind, the revenge of Kandahar against Kabul in many ways, and the ties between Kabul and Peshawar. The growth of Afghanistan as a state, the growth of Kabul as the capital of that state, has in some ways not quite alienated, but detached Kandahar from the polity. The polity of Afghanistan, centered as it is on Kabul, has a direct and ironic connection to Peshawar. The relations between Kabul and Peshawar appear to be kind of tight and intimate, where the relations between Kabul and Kandahar appear to be very tenuous, hard to maintain. So in the very, again, from the get-go, if you insist upon viewing Afghanistan through Kabul, please at least consider Kabul's relationship to other cities and the relationship between urban environments and rural environments, forms of migration between the urban and rural zone. Again, I've used the word migration many times now. I've given you a model of circular migration to reckon with. But migration itself, we have to understand, has many different, I guess, permutations. We have internal migration, for example, between cities in Afghanistan, or between urban and rural locations, or indeed rural locations within the rural zone. In other words, a set of migration patterns within the country. We also have a set of migration patterns between the country and the external world. Most, the four cities of Afghanistan have primary market connections to cities outside of Afghanistan. The other three cities, Kandahar, Herat, and Mazar, are less connected to Kabul than markets proximate to them. So, when we think about cities, we need to think about Pashtuns. And to be a Pashtun, it's hard to do in the city. Pashtuns are not city people. Of course you find Pashtuns in cities, but I would suspect generally moving through. Now, if Pashtuns aren't naturally city people, what are? Who are natural city people then? Well, we've got to look then at the history of states, and states are generally modern states, particularly urban-based. In our region of the world, states that are modeled on the Persianate tradition of kingship and administration and bureaucracy. We have a Persianate cultural and political tradition grounded in the urban zone. So what we have essentially are perhaps Persian cities, and if we want to reduce the hinterland of Afghanistan to Pashtuns, that's the danger. But for this heuristic purpose, we have that. We have Persian cities versus Pashtun rural zones or their hinterlands. This in itself raises important relationships, not between just cities and countryside, but between languages, particularly between Persian and Pashto. And that, I think, might be the hardest thing for Americans, and I'm one of them, to appreciate, is when the world is naturally multilingual. I grew up in a stunted multilingual environment. My parents, their natural language together as an Arab and an Afghan was English. But I heard Arabic, Persian, and Pashto growing up and then spent some time trying to study them. And I believe, with my kind of hyphenated identity, that that's really the most critical dimension of the mentality that's hard to capture. Natural multilingualism. And languages, like people, like all relationships, are not even. Languages do not relate evenly. There's an inequality between written Persian and spoken Pashto. That inequality, that asymmetry, gets expressed in many ways, but it brings us back to our Pashtun domination theory or thesis of Afghanistan. What's very evident in terms of the textual residue that scholars have to work with. Afghanistan is a Persian language environment. Historians that work on Afghanistan primarily, not exclusively, must work with Persian language documents. the state structure in Afghanistan has been predicated on Persian. The insertion of Pashto, the language, and Pashtuns has been historically uneven and generally kind of tension-ridden, not very successful. So while we have episodes or elements of Pashtuns and Pashto in the Afghan state structure, I'd like to propose to you, fundamentally, the Afghan state functions around the Persian language. Persian language bureaucracies, bureaucrats, stand apart from the Pashto language, which is textualized, but I would say still primarily more a spoken language than a written language. I would say primarily that there is a significant degree of print resistance in Pashto. There are lots of reasons for that. But let's say Persian ink adheres to paper really well. It seems like the Pashtun or Pashto ink is more like invisible ink or something. It doesn't congeal very well on paper. But we have to reckon with this dynamic between Persian and Pashto and Afghans that, in another sense, most Pashto speakers, if your mother tongue is Pashto, you will likely learn Persian if you're exposed to a city or the state or the education system. But if you are raised in a Persian-speaking environment with Persian as your mother tongue, your exposure to Pashto will be uncomfortable when you're forced to study its grammar in school, or when your title has to be Pashtunized, or when your document has to now have a Pashto translation. That's tension. We have a kind of a synergy, a tension between spoken and written Persian and Pashto that help inflect the changing identities of Afghans and Afghanistan itself. And to reduce Afghanistan to Pashtuns and others, or Persian and Pashto, is again really missing the complexity of Afghanistan, where there are scores of languages, some of them undocumented, actually, that are spoken. Afghanistan is not at all about just Persian and Pashto, or just Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns. Now, if I could, I'd like more or less to run through the history of Afghanistan with you, with some of these concepts in mind: migration, language, literacy, most importantly, all of which should serve to augment or complement a narrative of the history of Afghanistan that's ethnicized. Afghanistan has been ethnicized. The understanding of Afghanistan is through an ethnic lens. And again, I would say ethnicity has a biological component. Biology can mean race. And ultimately, Afghanistan is marred by racial understandings of Afghanistan through racial notions. And the American experience reveals how complicated really race is. How curious in the American situation with just two races, black and white, where I don't know many white people named Washington except George Washington, where Washington is a very common last name for African Americans. I don't know exactly how that happens. But race is a very complicated concept. It needs, most scholars have stepped away, if not abandoned, the idea of race as a method for understanding human nature and diversity. And with that in mind, I think we can do better than ethnicity as the trope for learning Afghanistan. So, the question I have about this deep history of Afghanistan. Let's just leave it with the pre-Islamic era. Fundamentally is what to do with it. What is Afghanistan to do with its pre-Islamic past? I suggest a lot can be done with it. I suggest that one of the challenges, though, of modeling the Afghan state with a kind of unitary Islamness is problematic because we lose the pre-Islamic, critical attention to the pre-Islamic past. We lose attention to the non-Muslims that have had significant impact on Afghanistan. But if the Afghan, let's call it the Afghan nation, and here again we've got some concepts, nation versus state. These are you know, complex issues. People have careers and write books on what a nation is versus state, and not to mention nation state. And for Afghanistan, we have to be very careful with the idea of nation and state, or even especially nation state. Afghanistan is not a nation state in my mind. But if the Afghan nation is to kind of fit nicely in the Afghan political kind of state, if there is going to be this comfortable relationship between nation and state, I think this pre-Islamic era offers some useful ammunition. And what we have in the pre-Islamic era are a number of migrations. The movement of, first of all, approximately, it's hard to date, but multiple millennia before the year zero, Aryan migrations out of more or less Central Eurasia into Europe on the one hand, but also into India, involved Afghanistan. The great Aryan migrations are indeed what Afghan historians have latched onto. Most Afghans have been trained to believe there are two things. The Afghan education system, in fact, has amplified two things. One, all Afghans are Aryans. The Aryan idea is supposed to surmount, or the design of it would be to surmount the ethnic diversity and distinctions. All Afghans are Aryans, and secondly, all Afghans are Muslims. Those are the unifying, I guess, themes that are kind of hard to actually put into play. But these Aryan migrations are the first critical movement of people to and through Afghanistan, and some of them stayed. We have Alexander the Great coming through around the year 300 BC or so. In his wake, we have a number of, I guess, relationships between kind of Hellenistic polities, kind of a synthesis of Greek and Persian political forms, as well as Buddhism. We have a kind of, around the year zero, we're experiencing a lot of Buddhist in-migration from the Indian subcontinent. And of course, you know, Alexander comes from the Mediterranean. The Indo-Aryans or the Proto-Aryans come from Central Asia. So even before we get to the year zero, we have three major historical movements of people through this place. The birth of writing, at least in some people argue, writing itself originates, at least the Buddhist version of it, in some of these movements. The historical era of Gandhara is where I'm referencing a kind of the origin of literacy. And I bring up literacy because right now Afghanistan is characterized as a kind of non-literate or largely illiterate environment. Historically, though, this is a center of writing, a center of knowledge, a center of intellectual educational pilgrimage. In deep time, pre-Islamic history. And so, really, if we could just move to the phase of Islam. Islam itself, let's date it roughly, say, 1,000 years ago, around the year 1000 AD, we know Islamization is happening in and through Afghanistan and indeed into South Asia. Islam itself opens up a number of new migration patterns, both moving into the country, but also carrying, for example, the Hajj, carrying Afghans out. So Islam ushers in a sort of new set of migration patterns to help us understand the country. And what I see historically during this period is a natural fracture of Afghanistan. More or less like this. Kandahar, during the periods, the centuries we're talking about, around 1000 AD, gets roped into the Indian Ocean trading networks that, of course, were generated by Islam in a very different way than Kabul, which remains attached to old Silk Road trading networks. And so historically, we have a kind of natural battle of trade and migration routes between northerly Silk Road type connections, connecting Kabul and Peshawar kind of to the north and east and west, competing against a network that sucks Kandahar to the south. So naturally, historically, economically, Kabul and Kandahar are detached. Piecing them together is historically and economically tricky, challenging. So what's important, clearly, within the Islamic centuries is the Mughal Empire. We can roughly say the Mughal Empire in India lasted from 1500 to 1800 AD, centered on Delhi, but very heavily involved in the area between Kabul and Kandahar, as was Safavid Iran on the other side to the west of Afghanistan, also seriously interested in Kabul and Kandahar. So for a couple of centuries, around 1500, we have the Mughal Empire in India and the Safavid Empire in Iran competing with one another through Afghanistan and Kabul and Kandahar. Again, involving different migration patterns, for example, of Shia communities in the country. But most importantly, during the Mughal years, the birth of the Pashto language happens with Khushal Khan Hattak in the 16th century. And it's very interesting how little celebration is given to Khushal Khan Hattak, the first person to textualize Pashto, not really celebrated by the Afghan state or the Pakistani state or India. Very interesting kind of no man's land for Khushal Khan Hattak historically. I suggest something could be done with Khushal Khan to foster a sense of community among Pashto speakers in and outside of Afghanistan, a creative use of his biography. But more to the point, it's the disintegration of the Safavid Empire and the Mughal Empire in the 18th century that Afghanistan emerges out of. What the standard line of Afghanistan is that it emerges in 1747 under Ahmad Shah Durrani, who unifies, I'm paraphrasing, the Pashtun tribes and creates Afghanistan. And he changes his name from Abdali to Durrani for various reasons, historiographically. This foundational narrative of the country is deficient in a couple of critical respects. And focusing on Ahmad Shah as the founder of the state and kind of inquiring, examining his biography with questions of Pashtun identity and mobility in mind, yield the following results. Number one, Ahmad Shah Durrani is born in Multan, which is now Pakistan. To celebrate Ahmad Shah's birthplace, you need Pakistani permission, I guess, is the bottom line here. Ahmad Shah Durrani makes his name in Iran. His kind of political fortunes grow in connection with those of Nadir Shah Afshar, who is the kind of a ruler who ends the Safavid dynasty in Iran, basically. But Ahmad Shah is exposed to politics and developments in Iran. He's exposed to Shiism and synthesis between Sunnism and Shiism. There's an important role for Sufism in all of this. But most importantly, Ahmad Shah is exposed to a Persian model of governance through Nader Shah. Ahmad Shah's biography involves a number of migrations to India in pursuit of resources, not just booty, but also political and strategic connections. Indeed, Ahmad Shah going into India could be natural, having been born in Multan. The migration of Afghans into India began with Islam 700 years before Ahmad Shah's time. It's unclear precisely what's luring Ahmad Shah to India. But it doesn't seem to be any Pashtun tribal or ethnic connections. Ahmad Shah's history is written in Persian. He's alleged to have written a compendium of Pashto poetry, a divan, that is, again, not celebrated, not extant, not examined. Professor Tarzi could maybe tell us more about that curious document. In his exposure to Iran, Shiism, Sufism, the Persian language, and India, and his birth in Multan, I don't mean to dilute Ahmad Shah's Pashtunness. I think paying attention to those elements of his biography broadens his Afghanness. And we have to really, I'll finish up in just a couple of minutes with attention to the colonial era, where in the course of two wars, some concrete understandings of Afghanistan were generated. Particularly in the context of the First War, when Mount Stuart Elphinstone was dispatched to, it's actually Peshawar, not Kabul, to meet Shah Shuja. And Elphinstone ends up writing a book known as An Account of the Kingdom of Kabul that becomes more or less the standard party line for what Afghanistan is all about. And you can see by the title of the book, A Kingdom of Kabul, there's a privileging of that city in the larger polity. Elphinstone, I would say, muddies the waters for us by giving a version of Afghanistan's rulers, whom he met then, as being Pashtuns, but really disconnected from their tribal homelands. It's clear the rulers are speaking Persian and writing in Persian, and Elphinstone's commuting with them in Persian. But yet he still, Elphinstone, gives us the idea that somehow Pashtuns are the true or pure Afghans. Like, there's a privileging of Pashtuns as the authentic Afghans in Elphinstone's writing, on the one hand, that is also Elphinstone's book, really important for drawing attention to the Persian features of the Afghan polity. So Elphinstone leaves us with the foundational understanding of the country, that is, it's destabilized by this relationship between Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns, etc. And Elphinstone's understanding of the country gets amplified through the surge in subsequent writings about the country. Elphinstone's foundational opinions form the basis of what we know about Afghanistan. Today, people are still referring to Mount Stuart Elphinstone from the early 1800s as the foremost authority on Afghanistan. So the colonial view and version of Afghanistan gets instilled during the course of colonialism in the 19th century. The course of the 19th century brought large numbers of Afghans into India and into contact with the colonial regime in India. And Shah Shuja is one example of being brought back into power by the British. And this repatriation of Shah Shuja explains how colonial versions of Afghanistan are transmitted to Afghans in diaspora and then brought back into the country. And so Afghans themselves have been exposed to colonial narratives of themselves. Afghanistan is trapped in a British colonial narrative. And surmounting that, or at least querying how those understandings came to be, what they leave out, their internal inconsistencies, identifying and highlighting them here today has only, my intention is to try to some extent, destabilize what you thought you knew about Afghanistan in a polemic, argumentative sense. I would like you to sort of question everything you thought you knew about Afghanistan. See if it really fits. And then we need to think creatively about some new metaphors to understanding this place that is still dynamic and mobile. Even if you think Afghanistan has been around for 5,000 years, it certainly has not, actually. It's changed. Afghanistan has changed in the last 10 years. And so this idea of isolated tribes and Pashtun ethnic groups being the same for thousands of years, keeping out invaders and stuff, that's just nonsense. And I guess maybe that would be an appropriate place to open up for questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, first of all, for provoking
us. Yes, you indeed did that. You asked about Ahmad Shah's Diwan. I'll just say a word. Maybe there's only one thing in life that I can say. I am now the only living person who's seen it because the second person just passed away. There is one copy of Ahmad Shah's full Diwan. It's a manuscript. It's in Pashto. It's held in Biruni archival depository in current-day Uzbekistan. I was allowed to look at it for half an hour. I did actually hold it. I copied the first and last page. They only allowed me a pencil. It is in Pashto. That is the last book by an Afghan ruler until you have to come down to the communist period that was actually written in Pashto. Ahmad Shah's son and successor, Timur Shah, wrote a Diwan. That I have a copy. That is easily available. That is all in Persian. There's not a single word of Pashto in Timur Shah's Diwan. And then Shah Shuja, who is the grandson, he wrote his biography, also in Persian, and Abdurrahman. Only four Afghan kings have left a biography, either a poem or a book. And Abdurrahman left a biography which is half complete. There's only one manuscript in London, and that's all in Persian as well. With that, so you asked about that. You're leaving us with some fascinating thinkings I'll come to today. You said that Shah Shuja was brought in from exile. The current leaders of Afghanistan, if you look, a lot of them have been recycled.
Yes.
They were either here in Baltimore or in Germany. Do you see the same pattern of the colonial period happening today? And if so, is that a natural way, or this is going against what you would think is the Afghanistan-ness of the country? As you said, that the fact that these people were multicultural, multilingual, was not an anomaly, but actually that made them more Afghanistan, that Ahmad Shah had an Iranian tutelage, a Pakistani or Multani birth, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So when you look at today, do you see the same pattern? If it's so, is this something that is workable or not for the realities? Thank you.
Yes, that's a great question. And I think while the principle behind the pattern might be similar, that is, the model of Shah Shuja being repatriated forcibly by the British in the context of the First War applies to subsequent rulers, and some people have even used that for the current sort of regime. But what's more important to me than the single individuals are the networks of confidants and kind of the entourage of these people that accompany them. And what we find
therefore, in comparing the two eras, today and the British period, are different networks, essentially. Today, we have a really important network, let's call it from American University in Beirut, where a number of high-profile Afghans with training at AUB are now a part of the governing apparatus. And although Khalilzad is not in direct play now, he is an AUB graduate. Anwar al-Haq Ahdi is one more. Ashraf, again, not currently in play, but another one. So we have, I think in trying to understand these things, networks of migration have particular nodes within them. For the British period, the node there were two, actually. One is Ludhiana, where Shah Shuja spent 25 years between when Elphinstone met him in 1809 and the British repatriating him in 1840. Spent primarily in Ludhiana. But also, a very important other location in India is Dehradun and its twin city, Saharanpur, where there is an educational, it's the Thompson College of Engineering, which is now the Roorkee Institute. But a number of Afghans were trained, Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns, in the colonial period in Dehradun. And in fact, Nadir Shah, who is another ruler, repatriated in 1929-33, was born in Dehradun. Nadir Shah, the Afghan king, was born in Dehradun, India.
Thank you. Please. And if you would identify yourself, please. And
sure. My name is Dan Plafkin. A lot of your lecture was a plea for multiplicity, complexity, and an understanding of mobility. And that sounds great to me. One of the challenges of giving a counter-narrative based upon complexity, multiplicity, and mobility is that you'd actually cause us to rethink particular instances in relation to the way the current literature actually challenges us to think of this material. And when I look back, and I'm not an expert in Afghanistan, but I look back and I think about key works, I see these themes echoed over and over again. So I'm not quite sure your narrative is all that counter. Give me a second to give an example. Frederick Barth's work on classic stuff that's recited over and over again, even by people you probably wouldn't agree with, grew up among theories of segmentary lineage in Africa. Barnett Rubin's work in Fragmentation of Afghanistan focuses on Afghanistan being at the boundary of a variety of different competing of spheres of interest. Magnus Marsden's work on looking at an anthropologist who looks at the current Persianate migratory patterns in present-day boundaries between Tajikistan and Afghanistan focus on, again, migration, mobility, and circulation of all these different things. I would think the stronger critique, instead of taking the foil, I'm not quite sure what your foil is, but instead of taking whatever your foil is as a foil, that you would look at like Pashtun nationalist movements and then show how those nationalist movements are reconciled with notions of trans-regionalism, with migration, with mobility, in its own mustering of nationality. So I guess I'm asking you two things. One, can you explain better what your foil target is, and is there something real there, or is it just a polemic at some press or something like that? And then two, what would you say to the harder stories of Pashtun, instead of counter-narrative, but Pashtun narratives, such as Pashtun nationalism in the early 1900s, or other moments for that matter?
Uh-huh. Well, really rich comments, and I appreciate you don't claim to be an expert, but you cite all the literature as an expert would. Particularly, I'm very impressed with your command of Rubin and Marsden. And I just want to say a word about Frederick Barth, because he is, I would say, an extremely important figure
as an anthropologist who's written on the SWAT Pathans, where he develops, the title of the book is actually Political Leadership Among SWAT Pathans. Very important book, actually, and I think we're celebrating right now the 50th anniversary of that book coming out in 1969, I believe. 59. So, what's most significant to me about that is that no one, to my knowledge, among Afghan scholars, has critically engaged that work. In fact, I'm not sure if political leadership among SWAT Pathans is cited very much, if at all, in Afghanistan-centered literature. I could be wrong. But the point that's interesting about the book to me is how attentive it is to issues of class. Barth argues that there is a kind of class dynamic in SWAT society that leaders and essentially mullahs or Sufis compete over. So one way it strikes me that Barth's great work has not been capitalized on is the lack of any attention to the subject of class relations in most Afghan literature. There's the point being, Barth emphasizes social class as an element in understanding political leadership among Pashtuns, but no one has, to my knowledge, considered rigorously the very real class distinctions in Afghanistan that form the political system. So in other words, the absence of class analysis in Afghanistan hampers understanding of Afghanistan. In that sense, that's an example of a very powerful theoretician who is not used or engaged to help understand Afghanistan. And if I've missed an article and someone has actually tried to apply Barth, I stand corrected. Now, precise moments and the larger question. If you want the foil, my foil to this is that the state structure in Afghanistan is can't be dominated by Pashtuns. And we can go at this from a lot of different ways, economically, politically, socially, linguistically. But that has practical implications, for example, when trying to understand Abdurrahman's period, for example. If we read Abdurrahman as a Pashtun ethno-nationalist, and it's very odd that the only ethno-nationalists in Afghanistan can be Pashtuns. We never hear anything about any other ethno-nationalists. But if we do want to gloss Abdurrahman as a Pashtun ethnic nationalist, then we do understand some of the tension between Pashtuns and Hazaras. Okay? But if we deflate the ethnic dimension there, and we add economic, class, and monetary relationships, what the view to me then becomes is not a Pashtun-dominated state beating up on non-Pashtun, non-Sunni Shias, but a state that is trying to kind of conquer its hinterland, as all states do. So if we look at, from the Hazara perspective, the brutality suffered at the hands of Abdurrahman as a problem of governance, not a problem of ethnicity, as a problem of economics and not a problem of Pashtunness, I think our understanding improves. Our understanding of the Hazara experience in the 19th century is improved by de-emphasizing the ethnic dimension of their engagement with the Afghan state. And this era is critical because of the, well, listen, I mean, I think every family in Afghanistan has a memory of Abdurrahman's influence, whether it's positive for the micro few that were in his clique. The vast majority of Afghans were negatively affected by his reign. And I would say Afghanistan itself is still working through some of those issues from 100 years ago, Abdurrahman. But Pashtuns are also among the large numbers of Abdurrahman's victims. So if we look at Abdurrahman as just kind of an ordinary king, not a special Pashtun king, then we can understand how Pashtuns feel totally, many Pashtun groups, I should say, feel as victimized by Abdurrahman's state as Hazara, non-Pashtun communities. And then we need to go further and start asking critical questions about how it is that Abdurrahman has been glossed as a Pashtun. So I hope that does some service in answering your question. I apologize if it doesn't.
And just the Abdurrahman also, as some of you know, was not born in Afghanistan, and his mother was not Pashtun, but was a slave girl from Badakhshan. And that's another one. Yes, please. He was born in Samarkand.
Thank you. Nabi Misnan from Kayakal. Comments about Baath. Leadership amongst the Swat Pathan. I wrote an article about him and I criticized that he saw everything from the point of view of the ruler. And it is a man, and several people have quoted me in that article. And also, Barnett Rubens will agree with you that Afghanistan elites have not always been Pashtuns, but in fact it has been non-Pashtuns. And that's absolutely correct. But my question is that if you deny Pashtun nationalism, then how would you explain that it was the Ghilzai, the Hotak Ghilzai, led by Mirwais in 1709, who brought down 150 years of the Safavid dynasty? Not only brought them down, but his son and his nephew went and occupied the whole of Iran for 30 years. That was, to me, all the Pashtuns got together in Kandahar, they had a jirga, they decided to get rid of Gurgin, their governor, and the 23,000 soldiers, and that's how they did. That's one thing. And then in the east, when Afghanistan was dominated by the Mughal, all the way to the Ghazni and sometimes even to Kandahar, it is the Roshani movement, which is again a Pashtun-dominated movement, who fights against the Mughals for over 100 years. They do not become successful in overthrowing them, but they weaken the Mughal Empire to such an extent that it becomes so easy for the British to come year by year closer and closer and eventually taking Delhi and so on. We don't see any nationalist movement in the north amongst the Tajiks. We don't see any nationalist movement amongst the Hazaras. We don't see any nationalist movement against the Turkmens or any other ethnic groups in Afghanistan. So how would you describe, how would you explain that?
Thank you. Please.
Yes, thank you very much for your comments that raise three very important issues. First of all, I'm not sure if I'm... I should say very clearly, I'm not trying to deny any nationalist movement or nationalist aspirations. And I don't intend here at all to deny the idea of Pashtun nationalism. But with Pashtun nationalism, right away we need to reckon with the two states that are involved. It would be Pakistan and Afghanistan. But more to the substance of your original, your comments about the Ghilzai rebellion against Safavid rule and the occupation of Iran. This is a very critical historical moment where it is quite clear that Ghilzai Pashtuns indeed in the vicinity of Kandahar did rebel against Safavid tax practices and the Georgian governor. It's a very important story, that ushers in what I would call a fracturing, really, of an identity, because subsequent to the Ghilzai invasion of Iran, we have the Afghan polity under Ahmad Shah taking shape, a Durrani Afghan polity. And what your very helpful comments draw attention to is how historically and culturally, maybe even economically and politically, at odds are Durrani Pashtuns and Ghilzai Pashtuns. And this recognition, and I don't mean at odds inherently, but they occupy historically different territories and have different relationships to other communities. And that might be one of the most important relationships to understand about Afghanistan. If there were to be improvement in understanding Afghanistan, the relationship between Ghilzais and Durranis historically would need to be really explored very critically. I would like to go so far as to say that it may be that we're talking about two different ethnic groups here, particularly among the Persianized Durranis, who have kind of lost their tribal and language roots. We have serious, now therefore, what if we do accept that we have a tension between Durrani and Ghilzai Pashtuns, then we have to come back to the question of Pashtun nationalism. What does this mean for Pashtun nationalism? And the surrounding question of what that form of nationalism means for Afghan nationalism more broadly. And it's very challenging. But I think the era, the early 1700s, the early 18th century period of Ghilzai revolt would need, that's not celebrated, for example. I recall, just very quickly, right after 9/11, this is also, the internet was not as well developed as it is now, but I remember looking on the Afghan embassy website in December of 2001, and there was a little picture of Mirwais Hotak, and then a picture of Ahmad Shah. Now, in Pashto, Ahmad Shah, in Persian, is Ahmad Shah Baba. Baba, father, Persian name for father. Ahmad Shah Baba, and Mirwais Nika, which means grandfather in Pashto. So, how difficult it is to incorporate someone like Mirwais on the historic foothills of someone like Ahmad Shah Durrani. Really quite a challenge. But I suggest that this is the substance of great potential and great learning and great sharing of perspectives and views, and doing the same thing for Babur. Babur buried in Kabul, debating, certainly no one claims him to be a Pashtun, but he's kind of considered maybe an honorary Afghan. Doing more with Babur as the honorary father of Afghans is one route to nationalism. He's a Turk. Yeah. What? How do we forget the? And we've never, in this discussion, not enough has been said about any of the Turkic communities and languages, not just the Uzbeks in Afghanistan. We're missing something horrible if we don't really attend to, for example, most importantly maybe, the Kizilbash community, which has that Turco-Persian heritage as well. So, challenges are great.
Right there, please.
How are you doing, sir? My name is Sergeant Dela Cruz. Earlier you had expressed concern that Afghanistan is being defined through a British colonial narrative. Can you provide examples of any authors or literary works that provide a different perspective?
Well, I am sorry to identify myself as kind of the revisionist historian. And believe me, That's not a very comfortable or popular position. It's and so I can say, I can refer you to some of my work, which is available online. I would refer you to the work, again, I think Magnus Marsden does some very nice stuff with the region. Ben Hopkins, B.D. Hopkins. I think there's some nice material dealing with the history of Persian language printing by Niall Green. So three names immediately come up. Magnus Marsden, Ben Hopkins, and Niall Green. Curiously, all British.
And if would you be willing to give a short bibliography later on, and we can pass it on to...
Absolutely, and,
okay.
And any publication that results...
Thank you. There will be a publication after this where Professor Hanifi will have his, and there will be footnotes, but beforehand, we will get a list for you, and if you could please leave your name with us, and we'll make sure that you get these with full citations so you can access them.
I would like to say, if I could...
Go ahead, please.
That, if the substance of my talk has been to kind of problematize the Pashtun domination thesis, in a nutshell, I guess, I should say that the information in support of my view is out there among speakers, among Afghans themselves, who don't write books, but speak. And there are many Pashtuns who don't believe, and far from believing, that Afghanistan is a place dominated by people of their ilk.
Payek, please. That would be the last question, would you stay a few minutes?
I'd be happy to.
If anybody wants to have a specific comments afterwards, we will...
Dr. Hanifi,
please.
First of all, I have a bias. My PhD also from University of Michigan. And when you finished, I said, typical Michigan critical thinking.
glad we share that, Harris.
Honestly, when you were going through your analysis, what you reminded me of Edward Said and his book Orientalism, where he accused how Orientalist narrative of Islamic culture influenced and shaped Muslims in the way of thinking of themselves and build up a lot of biases, and that opened up all discipline of different people start with a critical question. And I see that exactly your analysis, it fit that direction. When I did my dissertation, I was also provoked by the challenge, did Muslim have theater or they didn't? Orientalists said they didn't, and I approved the opposite. And it's kind of always we are find ourselves challenged by how the Orientalists describe our culture to us, and we have to accept it. And instead, when you apply some critical thinking with knowing the facts, you come up with a different conclusion. So I salute you, and you provoked more questions than gave me an answers myself about Afghanistan. So I thank you.
Thank you very much for drawing attention. It's not just Edward Said, it's the issue of representation. And that would be my, I guess, single word. I just question the forms of representation about Pashtuns and Afghanistan. And again, I am honored that you saw an inspiration from Edward Said, who has been an important feature in my development. Without question, there has been little existing critique of the forms of representation in Afghanistan. And this is the closest thing to practical military applicability. It's how the enemy is represented. If Ghilzai Pashtuns are being, and I've seen in other circumstances where they have been identified as the enemy, I think you're missing you're misrepresenting the enemy. Very critical. Thank you again.
That's it. Thank you very much. And as I said, Professor Hanifi will be here for a few minutes to answer your questions. And before we leave, the next talk we have will be on May the 3rd. It will be the presenter is actually in-house. We are doing some nepotism. It is Mr. Qamaruddin Jabbar Khail. He will talk about Pashtuns today. It will talk specifically about Pashtuns in Afghanistan and beyond, and who they are, where they are, and we would it will be same thing. 1400 is in this room. It's in the same very room here. We look forward to seeing you. If you need any tapes, as we said, or you want to be on our list, please see Mr. Adam Seitz and myself. And again, thank you so much for coming here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For further information, please contact Dr. Amin Tarzi, Director of Middle East Studies at tarzia@grc.usmcu.edu. Or Adam C. Seitz, Senior Research Associate, Middle East Studies, at seitzac@grc.usmcu.edu.